Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. To most Americans, it may look like nothing's changed since the Iran hostage crisis 22 years ago. They're still chanting death to America on the streets in Tehran. Most recently, during an anti-American speech by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But the Iranian people are also holding prayer vigils for the victims of last month's terrorist attack. And reformers have captured the popular vote by large margins. So, which reflects contemporary Iran? And might the United States now find some thin thread of a relationship with its old foe, the Islamic Republic of Iran? But first, a closer look at Ayatollah Khomeini's speech last Thursday. The country's spiritual leader railed against American arrogance in expecting the world to help it after trampling, he said, the interests of other countries. But the Ayatollah also signaled Iran's willingness to participate in a UN-led effort against terrorism. John Ward Anderson is a reporter for The Washington Post in Tehran. John, what can you tell us about the Ayatollah's statements?
He said that Iran did not want to join a U.S.-backed coalition against terrorism. And he used a lot of the typical language that Iranian leaders have used here over time, criticizing the U.S. as arrogant and accusing the U.S. of doing nothing but serving the interest of Israel. It did strike a contrast with many of the other speeches that have been delivered here over the last couple of weeks, which have been remarkably positive. Now, in fact, Ayatollah Khamenei has condemned the September 11th attack, saying that they are against Islam for killing innocent women and children. One of the interesting things, another interesting speech, was by former President Ayatollah Rafsanjani. His speech was much more moderate and much more dispassionate, and he really laid out, I think, Iran's case for what they expect and what they want from the United States in order to join an international UN-led coalition.
And what does that case look like?
He really wants the United Nations to lead, to be the umbrella group. And in this sense, Iran is not a lot different from many of the other Islamic countries in the Gulf region that also are looking for the political cover, that don't necessarily want to jump behind a U.S.-led coalition, but would like the political cover that the U.N. would offer. He talked a lot about the concerns of the United States acting unilaterally, and that he felt that if you wanted to talk about a broad international coalition, it had to truly be a coalition and not just a backing for anything that the United States wanted to do unilaterally. And it was, as I say, a fairly dispassionate, fairly well-reasoned analysis, although at the same time it did have a lot of the usual anti-U.S. rhetoric that you would expect from a top Iranian leader.
We've all sensed in Washington and London that there's the notion that Iran might somehow be an ally in this coalition. What are the positive signs coming out of Iran that are different from what we have come to expect over the last couple of decades?
Well, I think the first thing is that across the board, it didn't matter what their political stripes were, whether you are an arch-conservative, whether you're a Friday prayer leader, or whether you're an Ayatollah, or on the other side, whether you're a reformist politician or a man on the street, everybody roundly has condemned, in no uncertain terms, the terrorist attacks on September 11th, up and down through the government, from the Supreme Leader to the President to everybody. And I think it was the unanimity of that response that initially caught Western eyes. But then it got taken to the streets as well, and there were candlelight vigils in Tehran with people sympathizing with the United States. There was a moving, poignant moment at the beginning of a soccer match with Bahrain when 50,000 people observed a minute of silence. There was a leading reformist politician from Parliament who went to the Swiss embassy and on behalf of Parliament signed a memorial book. There were at Friday prayer meetings 2 weeks ago, there was none of the usual "Death to America" chants that are sort of a fixture of Friday prayer. And in fact, some security people reportedly went by and stopped some people who started, you know, the usual "Death to America" chants. So when you're sitting in Washington and looking at this, it must make you wonder whether or not there isn't a possible opening here for some kind of move to repair relations between Iran and America.
So, condemnation of the September 11th attacks aside, how does Tehran see the conflict that's now apparently shaping up over Afghanistan?
Iran has its own problems with Afghanistan. Afghans are Sunni Muslims, and Iran is Shia. They've had almost fought a war a couple of years ago when the Taliban militia went in and took Mazar-e-Sharif, a country in the north of Afghanistan, and massacred a whole bunch of Shia Muslims, including 10 Iranians, 9 of whom were diplomats. Afghanistan has largely created one of the huge social problems in Iran right now, which is 1.5 million refugees sitting out on the border. The Taliban allegedly has been involved in helping people smuggle drugs through Iran. There is a virtual, sometimes a war scene on the border between Iran and Afghanistan as Iranian security forces try to stop the flood of drugs coming across the border.
And how might Tehran see the fall of the Taliban? If through internal or external pressure the Taliban began to crumble or went away, how would Iran look at that?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on what takes its place. I mean, Iran has been funding and helping to arm the Northern Alliance, which is the anti-Taliban group in the north of the country. Its leader was Ahmad Shah Massoud, was just assassinated just before the attack on the World Trade Center by people who alleged Arab camera crew that came in and detonated a bomb in its camera and took out the leader of the Northern Alliance. But Iran has been supporting the Northern Alliance, and they clearly would like to see a regime change. And I think probably what Iran is hoping for right now, the one thing that they probably have their fingers crossed about, is that whatever regime comes into power, if the Taliban gets moved out of Afghanistan, is not going to be beholden to the United States and is not going to give the U.S. a huge foothold in the region.
John Ward Anderson is a reporter for The Washington Post in Tehran. John, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Two decades have passed since Iranian extremists held 52 Americans for 444 days as part of an Islamic revolution. This June, Iranian reformer Mohammad Khatami won a second presidential term in a landslide vote. But Iran is hardly a Western democracy. While the youthful population cries out for open government and personal freedoms, conservative religious leaders impose a stern Islam. The gulf between the two is wide and getting wider. 40 reformist newspapers have been shut down. Dissident journalists languish in jail. Public floggings are back. We're talking about Iran this hour. Are you ready to break bread with Iran? Is the war against terrorism sufficient reason to lift sanctions against Iran? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Joining us is Baman Bakhtiari. He is director of the International Affairs Program at the University of Maine and has lectured extensively on Iran. Hello, good evening, Professor Bakhtiari.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We need a little updating on Iran. For many Americans, our images are stuck back in 1979, but a lot has changed since then. Bring us up to date. What is contemporary Iran, and what's the balance between fundamentalist Islamic theocracy and this more secular reform movement that we're hearing about?
Well, the balance in today's Iran is that the society has changed significantly, and although the government still is very unpopular, and the image of the Iranian government is a negative image, this has given the impression that nothing positive has happened inside Iran. This is similar to pre-1979 revolution, that the image of the government was very pro-American, very pro-Western, and nobody could imagine anything negative happening inside Iran. So there is always this lack of equilibrium in understanding the domestic politics in Iran.
That's exactly what we're trying to break through tonight. So you're saying today we have this negative image, but in fact there's a lot that we might consider positive that's going on. Describe that to us.
Well, for example, Iran has had more than 20 elections since 1979. In contrast to the regional countries, I mean, just compared to Saudi Arabia, Persian Gulf states, Iraq, and Pakistan, Iran's political system, although it is controlled by the clerics at the top, it does have some flexibility by holding elections, by having a turnover ratio in the parliament. The Iranian parliament has had more than 60% turnover ratio. And in terms of elections, one can see that since 1979, the number of clerics in elected bodies has been reduced.
Help us understand first this tension between the democracy that you discuss, and certainly that's very rare in the Middle East, on the one hand, but then people get elected but don't really have power. Mohammed Khatami is in his second presidential term, but he still seems quite subservient to the theocrats, the Ayatollah. What is that relationship? How does that work?
The Iranian constitution itself has many contradictory articles in it. When it was drafted during the revolution, the people who wrote the constitution wanted to preserve the political authority of the revolutionary leader, Ayatollah Khomeini. So for that, they inserted certain clauses into the constitution. Since his death in 1989, more and more the popular elements of the constitution have come into conflict with the theocratic elements. So,
is there a mechanism in the constitution to resolve that?
Well, there is a body called Assembly of Experts that met in 1989 and resolved some of the constitutional issues. But getting back to your question, that it is not accurate to say that all the elected officials in Iran do not have power, because although they may not have tangible powers, meaning not controlling the military and national security forces, they do have intangible powers. They enjoy significant popular support. Should President Khatami one day come out and state his goals and say, I will call on the people to support me, there will be a significant change. So there is a power behind the scene.
And will that ultimately, do you anticipate, will that be expressed through some kind of super constitutional means? I mean, what will it take to shift the actual balance of power into the reformist hands?
The reformists have tried what we call the evolutionary approach, very step-by-step gradual approach toward increasing and institutionalizing their power. Every time they try to push too hard, the conservatives reacted, and we had a backlash. So the reformists have become much more pragmatic in the past years. So as we witnessed in terms of closure of the 40 newspapers in Iran, today's reformist newspapers are much more cautious. But in terms of foreign policy, they have much more latitude than previous period.
Does that mean latitude to work with the United States?
It includes, under advisory capacity, the supreme leader has been reported to listen to the reformist camp, particularly when it comes to Europe now, and also to the Organization of Islamic Countries. President Khatami has been a very important advisor to the supreme leader.
But do they look to you like a country that the United States could have a positive relationship with? They've only recently or still remain on our list of terrorist states, of states that support terrorism.
Well, relations with U.S. has improved since Khatami's election. I mean, compared to it 4 or 5 years ago, when barely there could be any kind of communications, never mind signals going back and forth. Today, so many foreign secretaries, foreign ministers travel back and forth to Tehran, and every time they travel, they are rumored, quote-unquote, to be having a message from the United States.
So far we don't see much result from that, at least at the popular level. They're forbidding the U.S. Access to their airspace in the potential current conflict with Afghanistan. Is there any material gain on the ground in our relationship with Iran?
Well, this is all new. We have to be patient a little bit, because the system in Iran, because it's so factionalized, all the leaders, including conservatives and reformists, have to be aware of this balancing act. They cannot simply take any decisions without domestic consequences. So in contrast to working with Pakistan, that United States can go to the military in Pakistan and just agree on one issue, in Iran, it is not that easy.
Baman Bakhtari, hold with us for a second. We're coming to a break. Listeners, we're talking about Iran. It's big and powerful, and for a long time, it was our completely avowed enemy. It called the United States the Great Satan. What about now? Is there room for a little shaft of light here? Might we be opening up new relations with Iran? Should we? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. If you want to learn more about the history of Iran and its politics today, log on to our website at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. You're listening to Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Iran. For most Americans, it's a country frozen in 1979, the year of the U.S. Embassy takeover.
Hundreds of people, some workers, some students, marching up and down, chanting their slogan.
Vital to the United States and to every other nation that the lives of diplomatic personnel and other citizens abroad be protected, and that we refuse to permit the use of terrorism and the seizure and the holding of hostages to impose political demands.
This is the face of Iran Americans remember, the hardline Islamic revolutionary. Today, it's just one face of a society divided between religious conservatives and more secular reformers. This hour, we're talking with political science professor Baman Bakhtiari. Also joining us in the studio now is NPR's Jackie Leiden. Welcome, Jackie.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Good to have you. Jackie Leiden has traveled extensively through Iran and reported extensively there. Listeners, is our shared dislike of the Taliban government in Afghanistan enough to start a new relationship with Iran? Do you think we can now trust the Iranians? And could contemporary Iran be a new model of moderation in the hardline Middle East? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Jackie Leiden, you have spent a lot of time in Iran, I think 7 trips in the last decade, and most recently within the last year and a half or so. Bring us up to date. Our images are stuck at the masses of angry students marching in the streets, taking over the embassy. What is the evolutionary path Iran has followed since then? Where is it now?
Well, with all due respect to anyone whose image of Iran reflects something that's now more than 20 years old, I'd say that we journalists who've been there haven't been doing our job if that is the image that people have today.
But, you know, Jackie, I think it's partly frozen because at some high rhetorical level, what we hear out of Tehran hasn't changed. And I think people link that back. But beneath that, there's a lot going on.
Well, I don't even know if that's true, because I think what we hear out of Tehran is a lot more nuanced now. And as you just pointed out, it's divided between what someone like the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini might have to say, Khamenei, and what Iranian cultural people have to say.
Speak to us from the grassroots up then. What does it sound like and look like today?
Well, I think almost anyone can get one image of Iran, which may reflect the Iranian films that we've seen here, reflect certainly, I think, the aspirations of a certain segment of Iran's cultural practitioners to show a country that thinks deeply about philosophical and moral issues, much as perhaps more, I would say, than we do here in the United States, because until 3 weeks ago, that wasn't really perhaps a hallmark of American life.
I saw, Taste of Cherry, very introspective, contemplative, philosophical film.
That particular film is really dark, and one of that was the Palme d'Or winner at Cannes for Abbas Kiarostami a few years ago, and he really led the wave of Iranian cinema. But there are many, many practitioners. In fact, I think, I wonder what happened to it. I was talking to someone who was arranging an Iranian film festival at Lincoln Center.
That in itself sounds like an oxymoron by the old measure. What's the, in the streets, what do Iranians think of America these days?
Oh, Iranians are wildly curious about America, know a great deal more about America than we do about Iran. They watch Oprah on satellite television.
That's not forbidden?
It is forbidden, but many people have simply gone to the small sort of DirecTV kind of satellite dish that we now have. This is, of course, a certain strata of the society that wouldn't be true. I think Bahman Bakhtiari would know this necessarily in rural areas. Although even there, I mean, I have traveled widely. I have never met with any overt hostility. Most people are curious. The Washington Post photographer I went over with last time actually found herself being kissed in the marketplaces. Now, I don't mean to say that every, okay, you know, Iranian citizen one would find is going to find, you know, people demonstrating that kind of exuberance. But there's such a lust for knowing more, not feeling isolated. And certainly, if we have deep and embedded and encoded pictures of Iran, so do they of the U.S.
But Bahman Bakhtiari, can that translate into Iran being some kind of ally in this new war on terrorism, or is there still an unbridgeable gap there?
Well, I think still there's the psychology of hostility is too strong between the ruling elite in Iran to settle right now for a convenient marriage with the United States. Mm-hmm. And as John Anderson mentioned earlier, there are a lot of issues between Iran and Afghanistan that is now will bring it together for the United States to have the similar issues.
So there's a lot of tension between Iran and Afghanistan. Yeah. Can you describe the source of that for us?
I mean, I would say there's a confluence of interest now that can bring these two countries together.
That is America and Iran.
And Iran. And, for example, Iranians have been very concerned with the drug traffic from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Iran shares a 560-mile border mm-hmm. with Afghanistan, and it has not been able to stop the refugees and the process of what we call terrorism in Afghanistan actually affected the Iranians first, because in 1998, Taliban executed 9 Iranian diplomats and an Iranian journalist.
That comes close to an act of war also.
It was, and Iranian armed forces went on alert, and there was a real risk of a war, which I think, again, was with the pressure of President Khatami, Organization of Islamic Countries, they backed down. So this confluence of interest now between U.S. and Iran on Afghanistan may lead to some form of a reduction of tensions and more collaborations.
I want to come back to how that might work, but we have many callers looking to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is on the line. Jay, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Tom. You have Jackie Leiden and Professor Bakhtiari, but of course Jackie Leiden is the leading queen in Iran because of her book, Why Do You Wait There?
The queen of Iran sits with us right now. Queen of Sheep.
Well, what I would like to say, Tom, is this. I wrote to President Bush about a little over a month ago as a freelance journalist that I am, follow Iranian American news.
Okay.
And I urged him, since I went to Iran a couple of years ago, I urged him to lift the sanction against Iran completely.
And what's your argument for that, Jay?
But my argument is this. First of all, Iran is a one of the largest countries in the area, strategically located, has more than 70 million population. But more importantly, how come our friend in Europe, as well as elsewhere, they deal with Iran? Last year, European friend dealt about $12 billion. So why not American company to compete in that oil and gas industry, at least make money or just compete just like anybody else?
Jay, let me put that to Bahman Bakhtiari. What has the cost to Iran of the U.S. sanctions been when Europe is not observing them? And if we would lift them now, what would that gain the U.S.? What would that gain Iran?
The cost of sanctions to Iran, I think, in terms of materials, have not been that much, but psychologically it's very important because many important companies around the world will be hesitant to deal with Iranian government under sanctions. And most of the deals that Iranian government has been signed or has signed with European companies, Italians, French, have not been up to par with the quality of materials that we get from American corporations.
But it sounds like it makes a marginal difference. It's not creating poverty, you're saying.
No, it's not creating poverty. We have to give credits to the Iranian government on many aspects that, despite the rigid sanctions that U.S. put on Iran, the regime was able to come out of his isolation, engage in a very intensive diplomacy, actually turn the Europeans to a critical attitude toward the United States.
And what's the U.S. looking for as the price of lifting those sanctions from Tehran?
I think U.S. is more interested in having Iran's attitude toward Arab-Israeli conflict change. Now, I generally don't agree with that approach, but I think in the past, U.S. has made this an issue between U.S. and Iran that they want Iran's attitude, quote-unquote, toward peace process change.
Israeli-Palestinian peace process.
Yes. Yes.
Can I just say something about about the sanctions? The very first series I ever did on Iran, the very first visit I ever made was in spring of 1995. And at that time, Iran had made an offer to Conoco Oil. I'm sure that Dr. Bakhtiari remembers this.
Yeah.
Was it like $1 billion development deal for the oil fields in Iran? And Conoco was considering this until the chairman of the board absolutely stalled it. And at the same time, this triggered in a then extremely reactionary U.S. Congress led by Alphonse D'Amato of New York, a sort of endgame as to who could isolate or who could deliver a sanction against Iran first. Now, this, whether or not we ought to have explored this deal, it fell afoul of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been perhaps a great opening to reducing tensions and normalizing relations. And I remember having a conversation with the diplomat who's mentioned in today's New York Times, Mohammad Javad Zarif, about the repercussions of these new sanctions. So, you know, that was one, I think, opportunity missed to normalize things between the countries years ago.
But let me put it to both of you. Are we dreaming here? I mean, there's still a powerful Islamic thrust in Islamic society. They still see themselves as defenders of a way of life and culture, at least in the rhetoric we hear, that's quite in opposition to what the U.S. represents. Is it a bridgeable gap? Can you imagine? Let me ask you first, Bamiyan Bakhtiari. Can we be allies? Can we be pals at some level? Or is there an incompatibility built in here?
Well, I think it's ironic that I think within Iran, American interests today, if they have an embassy, will be by far safer than the embassy they will have in Islamabad, which is continuously attacked and burned. Mm-hmm. And in many countries in pro-Western regimes.
Mm-hmm.
The difference in Iran is that in civil society, United States enjoys support. Whereas in many parts of the Middle East, particularly in pro-Western regimes, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Pakistan, there seems to be a strong pro-American government, but really that stance does not translate into the population.
Jackie Ledin, why is that, Jackie Ledin? Is it historical?
Well,
why
do
we have that reservoir of goodwill?
I think one of the reasons, and this is a very interesting reason, is that unlike some of these other countries, Iran has had a population explosion since 1979. The population has more than doubled from 33 to, I think it's something like 66 or somewhere, 67, somewhere
big
in
growth.
And many of those people, something like, again, 75% are under the age of 25. These are people who don't remember the Islamic Revolution, and they are smart. They are literate. They have been told to question authority, and they do. They don't necessarily, imbibe everything that they hear in their schools about the harshest aspects of Islamic doctrine. It doesn't mean that they aren't Muslims or good Muslims,
mm-hmm.
but they're a questioning, aggressive young population who want to be heard.
Without that burden of historical memory.
Well, actually, I totally support that. One can say today 70% of the Iranian population today did not vote for the referendum in 1979 that established the Islamic Republic.
Well, they weren't even around.
They weren't even around. So one looks at it, it is a significant generational gap. This young population has put significant pressure on the regime and continues to put that pressure on the regime. The fact that we have vigils on the streets of Tehran, but we don't have such vigils in other parts of the Middle East. We don't have such a what we call civil society participation, expressing their sympathy with the American public in other parts of the region. That, I mean, Jackie could substantiate that if she knows about it, but I have not seen yet similar expressions coming from peoples from other parts of the Middle East.
Listeners, what do you think of this new kind of message we hear coming out of Iran? Are you ready to change the U.S.-Iranian relationship? Do you trust the news of a secular impulse there that we're getting? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Masood is on the line. Masood, welcome. Are you there? Sounds like we may have lost Masood. Let's go to Jack in Newport, Rhode Island. Jack, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Great discussion. I'm just wondering, you talked about the role of politicians and religious leaders in Iran. I'm wondering what the role of the military is there right now.
That's a great question and a very important one at this hour, when we're suddenly facing what may be a common enemy in Afghanistan, in the Taliban. Baman Bakhtiari, where do the sympathies of the Iranian military come down? Maybe along the secular Islamic spectrum. We know in Pakistan there's a lot of fundamentalist sentiment in the military. What about in Iran?
Well, in the past 5 or 6 years, the Iranian military has become more and more centralized and integrated. So there is a great deal of professionalism in the Iranian military, and they're beginning to emphasize Iran's national interest more and more. So there is a mindset emerging in Iran that the armed forces in Iran will not want to have another war with Iraq that drags the country in, which is, I call it a national interest, very conservative mindset. But yet, you have the Revolutionary Guards that are part of a unit under command of the Supreme Leader. And Revolutionary Guards are representing that conservative clerics are more, one can say, in terms of viewpoint, internationalist, pro-Islamist. Mm-hmm. And they are hardline, so they are as much hardline today to go after Taliban as the army is. So in 1998, the Revolutionary Guard commanders actually were very critical, and they wanted to go into Afghanistan and punish the Taliban for killing off the diplomats. So it is a difficult, a very complex situation inside Iran that you have Revolutionary Guards now who want to go after Taliban.
Right. There it is again, though. Always these two channels coming out of Iran, the elected government and the supreme leader, who is a theocratic leader. The regular army growing more professional, as Baman Bakhtiari says, and the Revolutionary Guards. But maybe this new challenge from Afghanistan pulls things together. Do you, Jackie Leiden, when you're have been on the ground in Iran, is there an acute sense of people thinking about this dangers of the region they live in? The Iran-Iraq war was very painful for them. The Gulf War was fought right across the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, I think so. The Iran-Iraq war has a much more historical memory for people than even the Gulf War, because, I mean, a million Iranians perished during the 10 years of the Iran-Iraq war, and it was often called the Mullah's War, and they often used village boys to kind of, do this human wave to go and find Iraqi mines. It is one reason that, one of many complex reasons, why there hasn't been a lust for violent overthrow of the regime today. So, and everybody
they
has
don't
to
want to
do,
be vulnerable again, you mean?
Well, say. I just think that it has been, there was a violent revolution in 1979, and then 10 years
that.
Of war, and mm-hmm. a feeling of just tired of all that. But I think that young people, it's funny, I know a number of people, you can think of a poet friend who decided that he should do his military service in the Iran-Iraq war, and that's a sort of a treasured memory to him.
Mm. Listeners, we're talking about Iran. It's big, it's powerful, and it sits right on Afghanistan's western border as the United States looks very closely at Afghanistan. Is it time to take a fresh look at Iran? Is it time to perhaps search out the threads of a new kind of alliance within this anti-terrorism coalition? Let us know what you think. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. From WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Iran and what role it might play in the war on terrorism, what new possibilities there might be for a U.S.-Iranian relationship. We're with Professor Bahman Bakhtiari from the University of Maine. Also with us is NPR reporter Jackie Leiden. Callers, could you stomach an alliance with Iran? Is the war on terrorism bigger than any bad blood remaining between the U.S. and Iran? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Also joining us now is Kamran Beghi. Kamran Beghi is a Ph.D. student in political philosophy at Cornell University and press secretary for Reza Pahlavi, son of the former Shah of Iran. Welcome, Kamran Beghi.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. American listeners who remember all the trouble that came down with the fall of the Shah may be somewhat skeptical about a spokesman for his son. But we're eager to hear from you. Where do you see Iran evolving these days, and do you see new room for the U.S. to reach out to this country?
Iran, if you, for that matter, the entire region, if you want to, before we talk about what to do, we must understand what's going on in these countries. The dynamism in Iran, I mean the political, social, economical, etc., is the dynamism of forces of modernity and the forces of the nature that they are against modernity and they're clinging to the traditions of the distant past. Mm-hmm. By modernity, I mean a modern liberal system of government, social settings, which respects the individual liberties. And for an Iranian, what is of the most importance is the ability, the freedom to think for herself, to decide for herself, and to ultimately be the author of her own life.
Do you see that growing on the ground in Iran today,
Absolutely.
That freedom?
Absolutely. It's a process that has taken more than 100 years, and the Islamic Revolution was one battle that the forces of modernity lost, but ultimately Iran and the rest of the region are going towards modernity, democracy, liberal democracy for that matter, and to be living with peace with the rest of the world.
Let's clear one thing up right away. If Iran were to further liberalize, do you see any role for in the political arena for the son of the former Shah of Iran?
The report that I have from Iran, he is immensely popular, and he represents a system that, although there may have some mistakes, but at least it represented modernity. It was toward progress. It was toward making peace with its neighbors.
So do I read into that that if there were further liberalization, you can foresee a role there? Wouldn't that promote some kind of backlash in Iran?
Kind of a backlash? No, not at all. In fact, he's immensely popular.
Mm.
It's interesting what Mr. Beghi's saying. I've interviewed both Reza Pahlavi and his mother, the former Empress Farah, and they are extremely popular amongst at least a wide segment of the population and retain a huge I had a very moving statement from Farah. She said sometimes that she disguises herself as a student and she'll call an Iranian university and sort of ask about classes there, you know, and this kind of thing to kind of tether herself back in. I find it interesting that in Afghanistan, a monarch who's been out of power for 40 years could conceivably be introduced into the climate as something that might last. Certainly, a democratic monarchy. I mean, I've heard it all in Iran, and you know, it's an idea that gets entertained.
Listeners, there's another big idea coming at us: the idea that somehow the family of the Shah of Iran might again play a political role. How far out are we getting here? Bahman Bakhtiari, can you imagine that? I mean, they have democracy and elected leaders. Why would they need the family of the Shah?
I think if we just talk about the young generation in Iran who cannot remember the referendum of 1979, so I doubt if they actually remember what the son of the Shah even is located today. If you ask many of them where is he, so they probably you cannot mention it.
If I may interject.
Yes, please, Kamran Beghi.
I receive myself personally
yes.
an average of 2,000 faxes, emails, and letters from inside Iran. They're mostly students.
Yes.
And they contact me through emails or some fax that they are what they have heard, the nostalgic about the time of the Shah, the freedom that the people had, the freedom to dress, the freedom to talk, the freedom to the progress, the economic progress, the economical condition. They're all craving for that period. In fact, they're blaming their parents that why did you do this to us? Why did you put us through this system? Why did you go back 1,400 years in history?
Kamran Beghi, thanks for joining us and representing this view. It's been great to have you on the show.
We should not confuse the element of nostalgia, the psychological element of nostalgia, for the past, because the Islamic Republic has been so horrible in terms of its performance, carrying its promises, that it has created this nostalgia that every road that Iranians drive, if there's a hole in it, they just turn around to each other and say the Shah could have done a better job.
It's a little bit like wanting Mayor Rudy Giuliani to be mayor for life.
In another term. Let's listen to our callers on this front. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nina is on the line. Nina, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to comment on the relationship, whether we should change our relationship with Iran. I'm an Iranian-American.
Yes.
And I follow the politics and news quite extensively. And one thing I would like to say, I think before we do anything, is we need to understand the culture of Iranians and the people of Iran and the government and how it's different.
And what's the point we most need to understand there, Nina?
Just understanding how the religious aspects of the people and the freedoms they desperately are hoping to have and are in need of, that's, I think, very important, as opposed to some of the other Arab countries, which are inherently religious inside. And the people of Iran are mostly young people, as has been mentioned.
Do you feel hopeful right now, Nina, from what you hear coming out of Iran?
Not with the present government. I'm hopeful that the young will change the system of government, but I do not feel that a clerical regime will give a democracy at any time in the future.
Nina, thanks for your call. Jackie Leiden, Nina raises a very interesting point. We see many so-called moderate nations, which have this tier of U.S.-friendly government on top and seething Islamic fundamentalists beneath, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. In Iran, we have it the other way around,
well,
the theocracy
on
top and something more open underneath, perhaps.
And those governments that are seen as being propped up by the U.S. Have inculcated amongst many of their peoples a backlash against the U.S., whereas in Iran, which has rejected the U.S. for 20 years, you have a much more popular sentiment for it. I think that while you could point, I mean, I could think of countless examples, young women who've been thrown out of school for studying Napoleon who want to study what they want to study.
In Iran?
In Iran. People I know who started a magazine called Guftagu, meaning dialogue, and all the young people I know who have worked for newspapers over there, sometimes at the risk of their lives. Human rights lawyers who've taken on cases for women and lately, in the last year and a half, been thrown in jail. There is such a... I think, in a sense, the struggle to build civil society has really filtered out across the country. This is a feeling that is at odds with state-sponsored terrorism, with the blanket strictures of the mullahs. Mm-hmm. In fact, President Rafsanjani's daughter, who I interviewed extensively a couple of years ago, said that she found these interpretations of Islam far too strict. And I think that this is just a society. It's so big. It's so literate.
And it's yearning for
and
change.
And so yearning that I just don't think it can be contained forever.
And yet we're talking about U.S. warming relations. Bahman Bakhtiari, we're growing near the end of our time. But I want to bring up, there is this hard rock in the middle of things of Hezbollah and the terrorism that Iran is often accused by the U.S. of supporting there, and certainly by Israel. How deep is the commitment to that? Is that a surmountable issue?
Well, again,
just got a minute.
Again, Iran's support for Hezbollah has really transformed from the early 1980s, which was very purely revolutionary group, and they were going to use it as a movement for exporting the Islamic Revolution, to a new relationship today that it has transformed Hezbollah into a legitimate participant in Lebanese politics. Mm. And Hezbollah today is reviewed as a resistant movement, is recognized by the United Nations. So we have to... also,
sounds like that could still be a sticking point in U.S. political circles, Professor.
In the U.S. political circle is a sticking point, again, because of the Israeli issue here, that it is to Israel's interest to have the Hezbollah dismantled in Lebanon.
Bahman Bakhtiari, look ahead with us for just a few seconds we have left. What's the movement that we ought to look for now that would indicate a real change or that possibility thereof in U.S.-Iranian relations?
I'm cautiously optimistic because I see the geopolitics of the situation moving toward situation that both United States has to make some sacrifices on its previous positions in order to have Iran in the UN coalition. Iranians will, I think, in turn, because of the gravity of the situation, also take a position that will not criticize the United States. So I see a Gulf War situation of 1990 where Iran took a neutral position, yet gave its backing to the attack on Iraq.
Thanks. And Jackie Leiden, just a few seconds, but do you see room in the American psyche for a more open embrace of Iran?
Oh, I'd love to. I haven't had a chance to explore who decided to take Iran off the list of state-sponsored terrorist countries for a while and think about putting Iran into this coalition. I mean, I think there's a huge split within the U.S. administration that we haven't even begun to explore, because we've all been busy with other things, about what to do about Iran.
Much more to talk about here. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on Iran-U.S. relations with other listeners online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I want to thank Bahman Bakhtiari at University of Maine, NPR's Jackie Leiden here in the studio, and Kamran Beghi, who joined us earlier. We are at the end of our time on Iran. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in a segment we call Audio Diaries. Laura Roosevelt is a writer living on Martha's Vineyard who lost a friend in the World Trade Center collapse. She says she's seen how an attack by religious extremists can actually dissolve religious differences.
Brian's memorial service was held in New York 2 weeks after the day he died at the World Trade Center. The day of the service, unlike September 11th, was overcast, with rain threatening. Just like the day we got married, said Judy, his wife of 7 years, now his widow. Hundreds of people showed up for Brian's service. Judy's friend Ginger from summer camp, the president of Brian's alma mater, a former friend whom Judy hadn't seen since they'd had a rift 15 years earlier, a trader who had worked with Brian at Cantor Fitzgerald until 6 months ago, who told me this was his 10th memorial service in a week. Though Judy is Jewish, the service was Catholic, because Brian was a Catholic. He really believed it all, Judy told me. He believed in heaven, she said, and I wish so much that I did. The service began with all of us singing Amazing Grace. The priest, Father Ramsey, read from the scriptures and gave his homily. Then, at a nod from the organist, I walked up to one of the lecterns, and the organist played me an F. I knew that if I said any words at all, I'd cry. So instead, I just started singing the sad song that had been going through my head ever since I found out Brian was missing. It's about someone who dies in autumn, and it begins with the image of the singer memorizing the person's face by the light of a glowing fire. I changed the word fire to candle because I'd heard a story of another man at Cantor Fitzgerald who called his wife from a tiny piece of what remained of his floor and told her he was staring into an inferno. My voice was a little shaky at first, but even so, it filled the church. It was like singing in an enormous shower. Soon, I forgot about all the people out there in the church, and I just thought about Brian, who loved music so much that he named his youngest daughter Layla after the Clapton song. And I thought about his wife Judy, who was the person I was really singing for. Soon after I finished, Father Ramsey would talk about communion as a sacrifice. I am not a religious person, but I know now that overcoming my nerves and my emotions to sing this song was my small sacrifice, my communion. As I walked back to my pew, I heard sniffling around me, but I myself had not yet cried. Father Ramsey explained that today would be Layla and Jessica's first communion. They are 3 and 5 and too young under normal circumstances to take communion, but Father Ramsey said they were doing it today for their father. They were first in line with Judy, and I noticed with some surprise that Judy took communion too. But then I thought that, of course, she had to do it for the girls. She needed to do what they did, to be with them, a family torn apart yet still together. This is where I broke down. Judy's entire Jewish family, her parents, siblings, cousins, aunts, and uncles, all stood up and took communion too. Some Jewish friends of mine, even unreligious ones, tell me they feel intensely uncomfortable at the sight of a crucifix. For Judy's family to take into themselves what the Catholics truly believe to be the body of Christ was an act of monumental love. It was more than an expression of the depth of their feelings for Brian. It was a statement about the boundaries and beliefs that shear us apart from one another as human beings, and the need for us to cross those boundaries with understanding, acceptance, and love. 5 friends and relatives got up to speak about Brian, and later an old colleague of Judy's who'd never met Brian said he left the church feeling he'd lost a good friend. Back at Judy's parents' apartment for the reception, I watched Judy smiling and greeting people, and I remembered that I had actually had a good time at the reception after my father's memorial service. You see old friends. It's like a party. You're in a sort of dissociated state through it all. It's only after it's all over and you go home to what used to be your normal life that grief really hits you full force. I think back now to Father Ramsey, whose administering of the communion wafer to Jews could surely jeopardize his career, and I know that he is a truly spiritual man. These are no ordinary times, and he was not afraid to take extraordinary steps to help the wounded to heal, and maybe even to grow.
An audio diary from Laura Roosevelt on special coverage from WBUR.